Hello, everyone, and welcome to my podcast, Body Justice. I started this podcast because I believe that all bodies are good bodies. All bodies are deserving, worthy, and all bodies are whole just as they are. In today's world, it's ever hard to embody this as our truth. My mission is to create a space to process body image, eating disorders, and relationships through a justice-oriented lens. I'm a licensed therapist in California and an eating disorder survivor myself. I know what it's like to be at war with myself and also to find peace again. Thank you for being here, and I look forward to being your host. Hey everyone, welcome back to Body Justice. I apologize, it's been a minute. I've been off my regular podcast posting schedule as life has just been a lot, as I'm sure it has for you all too. But thanks for being here, and I'm really stoked for you to hear this interview with Stacey Finelli. She is a good friend of mine, and she and I are going to talk about the intersection of ADHD and eating disorders. This overlap is so common, and this is Stacey's area of expertise, so I'm so thrilled to have her here today to talk to us about this from a neurodivergent affirming lens. Before we begin, again, you can always find me on Instagram at bodyjustice.therapist or my website, www.eatingdisorderocdtherapy.com. My practice in California is taking new therapy clients, so would love to have you at our practice so we can support you in your recovery. So please reach out if you need support. Stacey, can you tell us a little bit about you, how you identify, and what you're passionate about?
Sure. So I never know what to say, like first and foremost, because I don't really put my identities in a hierarchy. But first of all, I'm passionate about dogs that you'll see in the background.
Yes.
So I'm an ADHDer. That is one thing I am sure of, and kind of an ongoing exploration happening of what the heck else my neurodivergencies might be, which I feel like is true of many of my clients as well. So that'll be relevant for our conversation. And I have some autistic traits. So that's what I'm going with for right now. I am in sustained eating disorder recovery myself. I am asexual. I have thin privilege. I have white privilege, despite my ethnic ambiguity, which did result in experiencing microaggressions growing up and put me in kind of a confusing place around identity and self-understanding. I'm passionate about what's considered radical mental health, but probably shouldn't be so radical. And autonomy-based care.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love all of your work. I hope everyone goes and checks out your page on Instagram and your Patreon. We'll get to that at the end, but yes, I love all your stuff.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about that overlap between eating disorders and ADHD? Do you see this intersection often, and why might it go together?
Yes, too. Do I see this intersection often? So often. And that's how I kind of got started in the intersection. Like, I didn't entirely know what I was looking at, but I was like, why it wasn't connecting, or there was this feeling of it being a revolving door, like something wasn't working. And that was frustrating them and causing more shame. And there was just like such a vicious cycle happening, and I wanted to know why. So it's hard to share like just a little bit, because there's so many presentations of ADHD and so many eating disorders. And so mathematically, the ways in which they impact each other are just infinite. But most often I see executive dysfunction and sensory differences impacting the relationship with food and the practicality of applying like what's considered a traditional recovery technique to our like actual life. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, malnutrition can exacerbate ADHD symptoms and bring them to light for the first time if an eating disorder provider is competent and affirming and knows what to look for. And it can continue to be missed and mistaken for the eating disorder, especially like what's considered quote unquote non-compliance, right? Mm-hmm. And prolong the struggle with the eating disorder too. So before I started specializing in which like 95% of my caseload is at this intersection, I was seeing this, like these specific overlaps in at least like half my clients at treatment centers, especially people who were just like the blame was being assigned to them as to why it wasn't working. And like statistically now I know that at least 17% of people with eating disorders meet criteria for ADHD, and that's just those who are asked and assessed, right? So
know that.
Yeah, in my ADHD clients who don't report an eating disorder, there's always like at least some struggle, past or present, with food or body image, or not even body image, but just the experience of being embodied. And whether that's conscious or not, like dissociation often serves that purpose, and there's a lot of dissociation within neurodivergence. So it's just, I think, you know, it's exacerbated by other factors, obviously, like diet culture, other marginalized identities. But I think like there's something unique between ADHD and how we relate to food in our bodies that is, I think, explained differently in every single individual.
Mm-hmm. That's making me really think now, because, you know, I focus a lot on the neurodivergence of OCD, which has a 40% overlap rate. And so if ADHD has almost 20% at minimum, and then we know there's a lot of overlap with autism and BPD, like all other forms of neurodivergences, it makes me wonder, like, is there more to the story in terms of suffering from an eating disorder for almost everyone? Like, is there underlying neurodivergence in a lot, like the majority of us?
Nailed it. That is, it's like, unfortunately, I think a kind of a controversial theory, which probably just stems from like ableism, frankly, sanism. But I mean, I've heard it said, and I'm jumping on board with the idea that eating disorder is a neurodivergence in itself. And often an eating disorder serves as a mask for neurodivergence. Masking is a really common, that's something I didn't mention in the overlap and why it exists in the first place. We do so much masking, we burn out. The eating disorder is like this one thing we have control over, right? But it can in and of itself be a mask, like this is something that is acceptable about me.
That makes so much sense. Can you explain that like concept of masking and neurodivergence?
Yeah, when I'm working through like unpacking someone's mask with them for the first time, we often start by asking the question, like, what did I learn that it was bad to be throughout my life? Like, and so often the answer is simply like a trait of ADHD. Like, it's bad to talk a lot, right? Like, you're monopolizing the conversation, you're being rude, or you're not being reciprocal, and people don't like that. So like, in order to mask, I overcompensate. So I do the exact opposite of that. And I will just shut up and I won't let myself speak and I won't be authentic. I will make myself small and quiet because I have something that is inherently shameful that, and it's sort of like, because I know that I'm not going to be perfect at masking, it's sort of like what ends up happening is like some of the natural traits seep out, which isn't a bad thing, but because I have learned that it's a bad thing, every time that my mask is imperfect, I feel shame. And wow. That's just exacerbated by the feedback I receive, which is just a constant loop of the original reason I learned to mask in the first place.
Right, which is rooted in ableism, right? Like this idea that we're supposed to be one way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So the behaviors of the mask, I think, are going to look different for everyone, but because, you know, also we come from different, like we're in some of the same systems, but we come from different backgrounds and cultures and family norms and everything. So, I mean, I've spoken to people who were criticized for being too quiet. So It's kind of this feeling of like, we can never win. There is no perfect mask. So like oftentimes the eating disorder actually serves to be like this sort of white flag, like, I don't know what else to do. So.
Mm-hmm. That makes so much sense. I mean, I don't think I've ever had a client with an eating disorder who has not been told either you're too much or you're too sensitive or you're too quiet. Like there's always this part that is just like really unaccepted.
Even the mask yeah. itself can be unaccepted, including like, why don't I feel like this comes up in eating disorder treatment a lot too, like just take the mask off, just be yourself, like we're going to help you discover your true self. And it's like, it's not as simple as just making the decision when this mask was created as a survival mechanism. I don't know who I am anymore if I've been doing this since I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of time to rediscover yourself after
I'm being blamed for that though, like you're being non-compliant because you are still trying to please us.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And maybe we should back up just a little bit because we mentioned neurodivergence, but for anyone that doesn't know what that means, like you're really big on providing neurodivergent affirming care for your ADHD clients, autistic clients, anyone with neurodivergence. Can you tell us like what that term means and what it means to be neurodivergent affirming?
Yeah, I get asked that all the time. Feedback I often get when I explain my perspective is like, that's not concrete enough for people. Like they want this like 5-step process to being neurodivergent affirming, which is actually like ironically a very neurodivergent thing to say.
I was going to say, that's exactly what I wanted.
I feel like it is a lot more broad than people want it to be. It involves a lot of like, honestly, what should be the pillars of good ethical care for all clients anyway. So like being open-minded and willing to educate ourselves, prioritizing our clients' experiences over like what we learned in a textbook, and like, so catering to brains, like almost as a microcosm within, like a haven within the ocean of ableism that is like, so neurotypical, the world is built for neurotypical brains. It was built by those in power who tend to be neurotypical because dominant power, sure. I mean, I could get into it, but like mm-hmm. that is just kind of the fact we're working with here. So to be neurodivergent affirming is to be a haven within that world. Like, okay, so things weren't built for you and you struggle, like the reason you experience ADHD, for example, as disabling is because in part the world expects you to have all these neurotypical traits that you just don't. And no matter how hard you try, you won't. And that would be okay if it wasn't an expectation placed on you. So in my office, like that expectation's not there. It's not supposed to be. It was, mm-hmm. you are, for example, like the lights are dim in my office, right? But like some people, that's for people who are hypersensitive to a visual input. But some people are hyposensitive and they really want bright lights. And so if a client tells me that accommodation doesn't work for me, we're just going to turn the lights up. Like, mm-hmm. I think to be affirming is to be accommodating. Mm-hmm. That is like the most basic definition.
Yeah. And like not pathologizing everything.
Yes. Big time. And to even like make space to grieve the fact that everything has previously been pathologized,
mm-hmm.
unpack what you've internalized of that pathologization. Like, how can I get out of the mindset of I'm the problem if everyone around me, including my therapist, is endorsing that?
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. So do you get clients that come to you and you kind of use this affirmative approach and it's like a paradigm shift for them? They're like, wait, what? Like,
yeah. Yeah, actually so many of my clients have most of the treatment, if not all that they've encountered previously was based in behaviorism. And I am like staunchly anti-behaviorism, oftentimes because that has been like the presenting problem that they're coming to me with is I need to recover from the effects of behaviorism. I've developed a fawn response to the people who would only validate me if I did what they wanted me to do. And what they wanted me to do was to behave in a neurotypical way.
That is so, I know like ABA is one form of behavior therapy. Is there a form of behavior therapy for ADHD?
I mean, ADHDers are sometimes put into ABA, even non-formal ABA. Like, ABA is just, frankly, I mean, this is a hot take, but like eating disorder treatment is ABA. ABA is just rewards and consequences for not doing, not meeting expectations. And the expectations are not decided collaboratively with the client. Mm-hmm. They're imposed upon a person. So ABA is everywhere. Mm-hmm. Just because we don't call it that doesn't mean it's safe. And so, oh, I should add to my definition then of neurodiversity affirming, like that it is, it needs to be a highly collaborative process to set goals, or maybe to not even have goals, mm-hmm. to just be like held and affirmed for the first time is sometimes a goal in and of itself. We don't have to be working toward change of any kind.
Yeah, really like helping clients deconstruct that mask. And like when you talk about the rewards punishment parts of ABA, well, it is just all of ABA therapy. Yeah, it makes me think about how it just creates the perfect environment for someone how to learn to mask. Like it doesn't actually, it's like parents that like spank their kids. Like it doesn't actually teach you what you did wrong.
It's a beautiful band-aid though, right?
Yeah. Like,
the person is responding with fear, they're going to stop doing whatever you wanted them to do. And I think like that speaks to why I have adapted this like social justice lens to my work, because I couldn't not, because why is our treatment the way it is? Because managed care has gotten in the middle and required those band-aids, like because efficient, speedy, definable recovery standards is like how that is basically being told you must mask in order to successfully graduate or complete this program, and then you'll be recovered. Right. And then if you're not and you come back, you must have done it wrong. Not mm-hmm. it was just a mask all along.
Right. Oh, that is so accurate. And I just see that all the time, you know, we both do. And it's really frustrating that these centers and insurance companies are not taking a look in the mirror. Like, how can you not? I just don't get it.
I think I also want to add the point that not everyone has access to masking. Like, so the more you mask, the more likely you are to burn out. And when you burn out, you lose the ability to mask, which is a blessing and a curse, because you need that mask to survive in many instances. But so like if you can't mask anymore, you become very limited in what you're able to do, which can lead to agoraphobia for a lot of people. Some people never had the ability to mask, and that's where we get like different levels of support needs. I think, whereas I'm like, very, very like a disability affirming perspective opposed to functioning labels and putting like levels of severity on any sort of disability. I do think it's valuable to name whether somebody is like a high masking or a low masking or somewhere in the middle, mm-hmm. so that we can like we can know what we're working with. We can know like what the goal is around masking. Mm-hmm. And to know like what's authentic and what's not, and to help the person discover that for themselves. So because there's so many different types of neurodivergence and presentations of ADHD, for example, like some people can kind of like grin and bear it when it comes to like, let's say executive functioning. Like I often experience ADHD task paralysis, which is just where like I literally can't do something, and I can physically do it. I saw TikTok the other day that was about the metaphor of somebody like putting their hand on a hot stove, and somebody was like, just do it. You can physically do it, right? Like you can take your hand and put it on the burner, can't mm-hmm. you? And the person was like, yeah, like technically, but, and she was like, so do it. And the person was like, okay, but I can't, like my brain won't allow me to do it. And that's protective. It would be protective if the expectation weren't there. So some people will force themselves to do it anyway, and it will hurt and it will do damage. And that's how we get to burnout, but they'll do it. And some people just literally can't. And there's no way to tell those people apart other than to just trust them.
Mm-hmm.
Say they can't.
Yeah. It reminds me of the whole, like, just eat.
Yeah. Right. That's such a good point. I feel like, imagine like that twofold or however many folds, like that's happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So that brings me to my next question. What does mainstream eating disorder treatment get wrong about food and like medication, treatment programming? I know that's a big question. So
that's like a whole podcast episode.
Whatever, like,
I think, so I'm still seeing from mainstream eating disorder treatment a lot of stereotyping about what ADHD even means in the first place. Like, you know, little white boys who eventually grow out of it and they can't stay in their seats. But even with that being widely debunked in recent years, there's still like an unwillingness to diagnose because of the idea that people just want diagnosis to use it as an excuse. And like, to that I say, an excuse for what? Like, an excuse to like, for their best to be good enough? What's the problem with that? And I think that shows up in treatment spaces, in those reward and consequence type program settings so much, because there's this idea that like we're lazy, right? Like we're just trying to get out of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that is internalized so easily. And the internalization of it is what chips away at our self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And contributes to the development of an eating disorder in the first place. So then when you go and you seek help and you get that same messaging again, that is not just not effective, it's actively causing harm. And it may not be apparent initially, but that is not what somebody needs to hear to heal. So I guess something that I wish people knew more than anything is that confirming diagnosis can give someone permission to start the necessary grieving process for like what could have been if they hadn't been so hard on themselves, and if they had set reasonable expectations rather than neurotypical expectations, and if they'd had access to accommodation. And then there's also a lot of confusion about what's quote unquote the eating disorder talking with what is an ADHD or trying their best. And if a therapist reads into a client always being late to treatment, for example, as like that's avoidance, not only do they end up wasting their time in treatment trying to figure out what's being avoided, the person is also labeled as avoidant and unmotivated. And then they internalize this truth about themselves, and then they might try to mask that. So you're just kind of building the mask. And so they've once again found evidence that other people know them better than they know themselves. And even if they do come to treatment with the diagnosis of ADHD, people don't always, that there can be a lot of shame there because of what they've learned about that in the past. So it's not just about affirming and finding and discovering. It's also about like recreating meaning attached to that, truly being strengths-based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because even if someone does get affirmed in their about their ADHD diagnosis and treatment, is it actually integrated in the treatment programming?
Rarely. And I haven't worked in treatment centers in a couple years, so I hope that's changing. I'm not holding my breath, but like what I had seen was, when it came to medication in particular, I mean, people were often asked to get off their medication before coming to treatment, like that those two things were contraindicated or that they couldn't exist at the same time. And so a new stimulant medication would never have been prescribed in treatment when that might be the magic key. And not the only thing, not a standalone, okay, now you can, this is the treatment for your eating disorder, but it's often the thing that like makes everything else quieter and easier and like, is just the thing that's been missing for years because of refusal. And even non-medication interventions, like just validating, yes, you have that. And like, let's talk about what accommodations would be helpful to you. Mm-hmm. Integrating it is so, it's almost like there's a lot of passing the buck, like, oh, that's your outpatient work. Or yeah, like we have to, you know, stabilize the eating disorder, because if you can't eat, then what good does it do? What does it matter if you have ADHD or not? Like that's, you know, there's this like idea of, well, that is life affirming. And the other stuff is just like side stuff. We'll worry about that. It's a lower priority. And like, they have to happen simultaneously.
Yeah. That's ridiculous. I was literally just making a reel about this, but because we see that with OCD and trauma too. It's like, oh, we have to stabilize the eating disorder first. But thing is, those things can fuel the eating disorder. So if we're just putting that on the back burner, you can expect that to likely get, I'm saying worse as a person with OCD, like my OCD would get dramatically worse every time I tried to recover from the eating disorder without that kind of dual lens.
Yeah. And ADHD, like, yeah, we don't want to say it'll get worse, obviously, because it's not a bad thing to begin with, but like the things that result from it that do harm people, like masking and like burnout and the emotional pain that comes with not being recognized, those things can get worse for sure. Mm-hmm. I think something that a common example that comes up in my work is when I work with students, with especially high school and college students, and they're told like they're eating disorder is like the reason that they can't focus or whatever. And like that they must want meds or they must want accommodations, like extra time or something to like make it to be able to like have their eating disorder at the same time as they can have like their good grades or whatever. And it goes against every like the right to self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
Like even if that were true, you're withholding something from them that is theirs to decide for themselves. But like I don't know, I guess maybe it's just the fact that I'm an ADHD chair myself. I just don't understand the insistence that if somebody wants things to be easier, they must be faking something or manipulating somebody.
Mm-hmm. Right. When it's like very valid to want things to be easier.
And if they can be, why shouldn't they?
Right. Exactly. Like recovery is hard enough. Why would we want to make it harder for someone?
Yes.
We kind of touched on this, but like the topic of stimulant use for ADHD during eating disorder recovery is such a hot topic in the field. What are your thoughts and how do you help clients navigate this?
So, I mean, often the thing that I'm helping them navigate is not even the stimulant use itself, but like getting people to prescribe it to them, which I mean, I could see like why that sounds kind of sketchy. Like I'm like gaming the system or something, but I'm literally just helping people like navigate around ableism. And so it's a lot of advocacy and education of providers who are willing to listen, basically summarizing for them that stimulant treatment is harm reduction at worst, meaning that like, okay, maybe it will suppress their appetite and the eating disorder symptoms will get worse, but also their concentration, executive functioning, self-esteem, et cetera, has the potential to get better. And so like that may even be short-term and we only know if we try. And at best, it can be a pathway to full recovery. So like, why would we just withhold that?
Right.
So like, yes, it has abuse potential. I think that's like the biggest thing that gets thrown out there as a rebuttal, but that's primarily in those without ADHD. So I think it does tie into people thinking that people are like faking their ADHD. Or that, oh, it can't be ADHD. It must be this other thing. And so if we give you a stimulant, that's going to cause harm. But I've seen a lot of social media posts about like, they say that I can get addicted to my stimulant, but I can't even remember to take my stimulant half the time. Thank God that's relatable. Yeah, I actually like, I've been on and off with so many different doctors myself, because I'm like, why am I paying you to refill a thing that I can't remember to take half the time? And I think I'm limited in my scope as to what I can say about like how stimulants work and what's appropriate and stuff. But in my experience of what I've observed and what has been a personal experience for me, it's actually so hard to get stimulant medication prescribed to you for the reason of abuse potential, but the process of trying to manage our symptoms for the sake of recovery through medication is shame inducing. Mm-hmm. And that is because of that accusation in the first place. Like the language people will use is like, I'm being treated like a criminal, or I'm being treated like an addict, which is unfortunately also pathologizing.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't think there's any research around this, and there needs to be, but like, I have on more than one occasion had people come to me like for addiction because they were self-medicating because they couldn't access stimulants in the first place. Yeah. And then that inherently made them ineligible for stimulant medication or stimulant treatment. And I do think that like, you can just like, if you replace the thing with something that's less harmful, like that's it. That's the problem is solved. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. That logic doesn't seem to register, I think, because of the liability and the risk that doctors are assuming. Mm-hmm. The only way for a person with ADHD to abuse stimulants is via their intention. Mm-hmm. So this is, I'm specifically referring to eating disorders here. If their symptoms are manageable through non-medication interventions or non-stimulants or a lower dose of stimulants, but they're dishonest about it because of a desire to suppress their appetite, that's abuse. Mm-hmm. But I've never actually seen that happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying it couldn't, and I'm sure it does, but I trust my clients to be honest with me about that. And if I were to be the kind of provider who would say, I don't think you should be on those because you're going to abuse them, my clients probably would not be honest with me about it. Mm-hmm. So like maintaining a trusting relationship with them and helping them know that I'm on their team is, if there is a struggle with intention that leads to abuse and appetite suppression, we can work through that together.
Yes. It's not like a punishment or, oh, you're really bad or you're doing this wrong. Like, yeah, I feel like this is like a broader issue too of like gatekeeping drug use. Like, I'm just going to say drug because I think all substances, where there's so much fear that you're going to like cause an addiction. But number one, that's not how addiction works. Number two, people will find other ways to get their needs met. So I saw this all the time when I worked in like a crisis center for dual diagnosis. And so many times people would come in with drug abuse, but really they were self-medicating because they didn't have access to the medication they really needed. Yeah. So it's like,
and then that loops in a vicious cycle. Like now, because of your addiction, you can't have the thing that would help your addiction.
Right, which makes zero sense. It's so aggravating. And like with stimulant and hunger stuff, like hunger cues are not the like be all end all of recovery. Like those are all, I feel like, are just always going to be finicky when you have an eating disorder or eating disorder history. Like we're just a little more sensitive to that stuff.
Also factor in the fact that specifically ADHD and autism, we often struggle with hypersensitivity to interoceptive input, meaning that we feel a lot of the cues that our body gives us, from hunger cues to thirst cues to having to go to the bathroom to is our heart beating fast, which is also help us or make it harder to recognize emotions. Like there's a lot of factors there, but that's the thing that comes up with stimulants all the time. It's like somebody already has low interoceptive awareness.
Yeah.
We've already needed to adapt intuitive eating and like create a structured eating time or meal plan or whatever that may last indefinitely anyway. So mm-hmm. if we can do that for some people, even if you don't struggle with interoceptive awareness, why can we not do that for you with stimulants as well?
Mm-hmm. Right. Recovery is so much more about being able to nourish yourself adequately and consistently, regardless of hunger cues. Like that's just not a reliable, like, I mean, it's also just like extremely ableist in other ways too. Like people with chronic illnesses that may never have hunger cues or I don't know. I think about what you said about the hyposensitivity, and that's interesting because with OCD, there's like a hypersensitivity. Like, so like an over-focus on are they there, are they not, creates so much anxiety that you may, then they're just not going to be there. Right. So.
Right. Can I trust myself anyway? Like those things are always coming. I mean, it doesn't even matter, right? If we're questioning, like, is that a real hunger cue? Is that not? I'm waiting for it. I don't know if it's going to come back. Like, I do think like structured, quote unquote, mechanical eating is more often than not an important part of recovery for all neurotypes. So mm-hmm. like, what is our opposition to just implementing that indefinitely as long as somebody is taking a medication that impairs those cues?
Right.
I think it was Dr. Gaudiani on your podcast who said, like, eating disorders don't result from poor appetite. That's not what an eating disorder is.
Right. Exactly. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And that just, I don't know, when I was in like active recovery, I got to a point where I was like obsessed with, am I hungry? Am I not? Like that hypersensitivity. So then that would just like take me completely out of being able to nourish myself. So it's very interesting to now think about how that just wasn't addressed at all.
Yes. Oh my God. Same. One other thing I'll say about stimulants is specific to binge eat, because there is actually, Vyvanse is approved for the treatment of binge eating disorder. And I have a lot of feelings about that because I think it stems from, I mean, it's not even stems from, it is overt fat phobia. Mm-hmm. Even though people in all of all body types can have binge eating disorder, I think it's this very, very superficial belief on the part of the medical community. We just take their appetite away, they won't binge anymore, and then we'll be good to go, right? Mm-hmm. So like, why do we rush to prescribe stimulants to people with binge eating disorder, but whether they have ADHD or not, but we are so incredibly restrictive and debating whether they're appropriate for people with other eating disorders.
Right. So true. I've seen that so much with clients in larger bodies where doctor doesn't even really ask them if they want that. It's just like, oh, here's this that'll help with your depression and you'll probably lose some weight.
Like if an ADHDer is binging, I'm for stimulants, but not to suppress appetite, to support time awareness, feelings of adequacy and mastery, motivation, the same thing I would for any other eating disorder. Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody comments on an Instagram post they made about this topic and saying, why is this only geared for anorexia? And I was like, well, I said restrictive eating disorders, not anorexia. And that's all eating disorders, all eating disorders. Including binge eating disorder. So that's you projecting, my friend.
Yes, I think I remember that. But yeah, that's so true. It's like there is no, binge eating is not really about the eating. It's so much more. Mm-hmm. So even giving someone a stimulant isn't going to be like a cure-all.
It's not. And, you know, the thing that's really common in stimulants too, is if it does, and not everyone experiences appetite suppression. Some people have told me that it makes them more hungry. I don't think that's the norm, but it can happen. But like a lot of times if somebody does lose their appetite during the day, there's this like rebound binge eating that happens when the stimulant wears off at night. And then there's like this like feeling of being out of control. Like, okay, well now I've like quote unquote swung the other way. I was restricting and now I'm binging and now I'm ashamed of that. But like the medicine made me do it, which is again, why mechanical structured eating can be so important.
Mm-hmm. It's like a lifelong skill. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on self-diagnosis when it comes to ADHD? Because it is so hard to get.
So I feel like probably obvious that I'm in the self-diagnosis is valid camp, but I hear people say that more often than I used to, which is awesome. I'm glad about that. But there's still, I think even when people say that, they mean it's valid as in I will believe you that you have it, but also like, make sure you check with your doctor to make sure that they agree before you like do anything about it. And I think it should mean more than that to say it's valid. Mm-hmm. There's still so much gatekeeping around self-diagnosis. And I think that's in part due to ego, clinician ego. I think the gatekeeping that's done by clinicians is it's like, well, I know best, I read this textbook, but.
That's so gross to me.
I know, because it cuts off, like diagnosis has so much potential, not just for treatment, because ADHD is not something that needs to be treated per se. We're not trying to heal from it inherently. We're trying to heal from the effects of, like, I feel like I've said this over and over in different ways, but we're trying to heal from like the ways that we're marginalized because of it. But I also think that there's gatekeeping that happens from like two different directions. We have like neurotypical people gatekeeping diagnosis because who wants to deal with the power differential change, and like what if it's actually not typical to be, what if neurodivergence is actually like the dominant group after all, and that's a threat, that the way like I may, the tables may turn if I'm not in the majority anymore. Right. So similar to me to the whole like participation trophy argument, like if everyone gets one, then it's not special anymore. Mm-hmm. And then neurodivergent people who gatekeep within our own community, I think do so because they struggle with like, if more people have access to this, then like I may not get the support that I need anymore, which I don't think is what happens. I think, you know, it's liberation for all of us. You know, we're not free until we're all free. This is also where we get like functioning labels and levels of severity, the need to say like, oh yeah, well, you're not, your ADHD isn't as bad as mine because you can, you know, you can study for longer than I can, comes from like a threat response. Mm-hmm. Like, is my ADHD not real?
Mm-hmm. And like sort of the scarcity mindset too around care, which makes sense in our current landscape.
It's so fair. And also the people who tend to gatekeep, the neurodivergent people who tend to gatekeep, have been delegitimized themselves throughout their lives. So it makes sense mm-hmm. that they would kind of repeat that to keep it going. But we end up fighting each other. We fight our own allies.
Yeah. It makes me think about, I think I've been seeing this on TikTok, I think, or maybe it was Instagram, but like this shortage of ADHD medication right now.
Yeah.
Is that like adding to this sort of scarcity on both ends, providers and clients?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's that originated from different like virtual ADHD like treatment options that were kind of like sketchy and just not being well done, like providers not getting to know people well enough to actually say if they had ADHD or not. And like that's, it's weird to say there's valid gatekeeping, but like I feel like I would say that that was true of anything, whether it was ADHD or another diagnosis. Like you can't know, there's so much, there is a really nuanced differential diagnosis that has to happen with ADHD. It looks like so many things, bipolar, trauma. There's a very extensive list, autism, even OCD. Mm-hmm. I rushed through trauma, but like there is no non-traumatized neurodivergent person existing in society where the systems aren't made for us. So how can we differentiate? How can you say to somebody, you don't have ADHD, that's just trauma, when it's mm-hmm. it could very easily be both and they could look exactly the same.
Yeah.
And what's the point? What is, so what?
Mm-hmm. Oh, so I see.
If there's support available to me, if I do in fact have this diagnosis that wouldn't be otherwise, why would you withhold that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like it's really hard to actually get an ADHD diagnosis. Like even as therapists, we're not allowed to do ADHD assessments unless we have some special certification.
Right? Like you don't even know.
They
don't tell us what we need. No. Even in the neurodivergent affirming therapists Facebook group, people like ask the question all the time, what do I need to diagnose? Like we don't even know within our own specialty. The truth of the matter is there are like certain states that allow you to with different degrees, and it's very hierarchical. If you consider yourself a specialist, you can diagnose anything in the DSM technically, but like sometimes people shouldn't consider themselves specialists, right? And mm-hmm. it's very difficult to get a diagnosis because people think it's, because there's technically neuropsych testing, which is a very extensive, like 4-day, many, many hours worth of testing that like confirms your diagnosis. And that's often, well, it's not covered by insurance and it's thousands of dollars. And that's what you need to get access to like university accommodations and things that will like actually like contribute to where you stand in this capitalistic society. Like, can I get my degree and make more money than the other person, and workplace accommodations, like all the stuff that matters the most is the hardest to get.
Mm-hmm. That is so stupid to me. Like I've literally like looked up like ADHD questionnaires for therapists and like things like that to just help clients get an idea. Mm-hmm.
I think that that's a great start, right?
Yeah.
And that's why self-diagnosis is valid, is like, even if you, and like, I do think like by saying I can't diagnose you because you know that that's not a thing that you feel confident or comfortable in, you're still doing your client a service, right? You're like exploring it with them and trying to open avenues for them to explore it with somebody who can say.
Yeah, exactly. It's so,
it's a balance.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like informing, like, oh yeah, this takes additional testing, you know, neuropsych testing, and let's explore some of the symptoms and see if they're a fit for you to see if you want to pursue that. Because if it's thousands of dollars, no one has just thousands of dollars just sitting around.
Right.
Or very few people. I guess what's advice you would give someone currently going through eating disorder treatment who also has ADHD?
Like, the easiest thing to say is advocate, 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 but like with the caveat that I know that it's really scary to risk being perceived as the squeaky wheel or like having too many needs or other people thinking that you think you're special and the shame that comes with that and being told that's just the eating disorder. So like advocating is easier said than done, especially because our advocacy is so often seen as a symptom or as the problem itself. I would just really encourage you to remember that those responses are other people's ableism. That's their crap. That's not yours. Like separating internally, like doing your work to separate when am I not the problem? And when have I not been the problem in the past when I've attributed it to myself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so powerful. Really good advice for anyone navigating that, to start chipping away at that internalized shame and externalized shame.
More tangibly, I would definitely encourage you to follow neurodivergent accounts on social media and share those with therapists. Consider, if you have access to it, finding a provider who is affirming and asking big questions like, what does it mean to you to be affirming? And will you try to get me to change? And how do you feel about whether, you know, intuitive eating is accessible to all people? Like kind of those like eyebrow raising, like, not gonna tell me a whole lot kind of questions. And not to settle for just anyone if it's possible. And if it's not possible, you still get to set your own agenda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm thinking about like finding support groups or books that can just supplement. And maybe hopefully if you have a therapist, maybe this is new to them, but hopefully they'd want to do that learning for you. Because basically we need more Stacey's out there, because there is just not enough of you.
This is why I started compiling an Excel spreadsheet online of
who
define neurodivergent affirming the same way I do.
Yeah. I love that spreadsheet. Can you tell listeners about your work, where to find you, and how to keep up with you?
Sure. So I work at two practices in Southern California. You can find me at those websites, Equilibrium Counseling Services and Monarch Therapy and Nutrition Services. But more interestingly, I am on Instagram as EDADHD_therapist. That's the same for my Patreon, where I'm doing like kind of just resources, handouts, like advocacy support tools and stuff, as well as monthly webinars on different topics within not just ADHD, but the broad neurotype of neurodivergence. And I've just started a autistic and ADHD eating disorder support group. So, and I'm doing, you know, a couple talks here and there. I'm not a huge talker, but I'm trying to become more of one. So there'll be more of that coming.
Yay. Oh my gosh. And I feel like you didn't hype yourself up enough, because your Patreon is amazing. So is your Instagram. Like, I've learned so much from you, and you have amazing tools and resources and the support group. Like, are you still taking new people?
Yeah, it's actually, I was really surprised at the turnout. It's full for this month. So I'm assuming that it's going to keep getting like that. It's going to be monthly, and I tried to make it's pretty equitable. Low fee and free for Patreon people. So yeah, I just feel like there's not enough out there. So I'm just like, okay, how do I like reach more people?
Mm-hmm. That's so awesome. I'm going to put links to all that in the show notes. And yeah, I hope everyone follows you and checks out your resources, because they're so good.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm not a self-hyper. I got to work on that. That's my own internalized stuff. See, I'm still doing my work.
Yeah. So this is why when I asked you to hype me up for the abolition talk, there was silence.
Yes. Yes. Well, because I'm like, my love language is not words of affirmation. It makes me uncomfortable and I don't trust people. So then I assume everybody else feels the same way I do, but clearly I have work to do.
Interesting. I like all the love languages. What does that mean about me?
Like, I can't get enough love.
All right. Thank you, Stacey.